This is a Cyber Union talk show for Monday, February 6th, 2012. F it. We'll call it Pipe Soup. Welcome to the show. My name is Steven from Mexico City, and with me is not Walton. He is still on his honeymoon, so instead we have done a special show this week, and we have two guests, one of which is from the Music Manumit Lawcast.
Hi, I'm Doug.
Hello, Doug. You are starting this Music Manumit Lawcast. It's brand new, right?
Yeah, so we have a couple posts up, but no actual shows yet. We're going to get down to business in the summer.
Uh-huh.
But we have the opportunity to talk to Parker, and I didn't want to miss that episode.
Definitely. But now your Music Manumit Lawcast is going to be you and who else?
Nick Clark, who is a Pennsylvania lawyer. We'll call him a Pennsylvania lawyer. He's definitely a lawyer. Whether or not he wants to claim Pennsylvania, I'll leave up to him. He can speak for himself when he gets on the show.
Nice. Pennsylvania. What part of Pennsylvania?
He was in Philadelphia for a while. He's in D.C. right now, and he's in the middle of moving. And I'm not sure if he knows where he's going to be long term, because his wife is still in Philly. I think. I wouldn't swear to that.
Oh, okay.
But I think his wife is still in Philly. She's in school, I think. I'm like being very lawyerly about not putting my foot down about any of these things.
Yes.
Allegedly, he is in D.C.
Allegedly. Fair enough. And for our listeners to know, Doug is currently in law school in the I can't say great state of New Hampshire, but the state of New Hampshire.
Live free or die.
Yes, and I used to say die when I worked on a campaign up there because I hate the damn fucking voters up there. Pardon my French. but have fun there.
It works out, though, to a certain extent, that I lean more towards the anarchist and am living in New Hampshire, and you were at one time in Massachusetts and lean to the left, if you want to do the left-right, you know, that sort of thing.
Well, anarchists are all kind of all over the place.
Yeah, that's why I was like, left, right, what is it really? Yeah, no, anyway, we should move on.
Yes, we should. Anyhow, so to kind of set up what we've done today, we have Parker Higgins from the EFF coming onto the show as our guest. But the reason that this is really important is a lot of our listeners, I'm sure, have found out or experienced the wonderful blackout that occurred on the 18th of January. Either they experienced it or read about it afterwards in opposition to SOPA and PIPA, which I do have to say is really kind of funny down here because in translation it means pipe soup and not like a pipe, like a water pipe, but like a smoking pipe if you do the direct translation. But anyhow, its impact is really important, I think, for the community that we have. And I wanted to kind of go over, and it's really great to have Parker as a guest and looking forward to where this discussion goes.
And I want to say too, that you and I talked a little bit about potentially doing a second show with Parker. So people that don't necessarily always give feedback, that's something that would be really important to do this time, because if we do have Parker back on for some more trade union oriented stuff rather than the SOPA internals that we got into mostly in the interview, it'll be good to really have pointed questions for that. So definitely get back in touch with Steven, or I'm gonna say, or Walton too, even though he's not here.
Yes, definitely. And as we have links in the show notes for people that need space to respond, but there's also comments on our site as well as the different social medias that we use. So for anybody that doesn't know our current site, with no further ado, Douglas, I think we should jump right into the interview.
Sounds good. And so just so people have some understanding of sort of where the conversation is going, this is a little bit different from what Steve and I normally do. So Steven, as many people will know, co-hosts the Cyber Unions podcast, and I co-host a couple different podcasts, but the one that we brought you on here for was the Music Manumit Lawcast. And I think that looking at it from both sort of the activist point of view and the legal point of view is in particular interest in for these bills in the way that the activism led and sort of the way in which the discussion happened about the legal. There's a lot of legal process involved in some of the reasons why that people were so angry, I mean, in the process of the legislation, but also just why they felt that some of it was misguided. And one of the reasons why that there was so much legal discussion in this was that we already have bills to do some of the things SOPA was purported to do. So just to give some background for people who aren't familiar, what were some of the ways in which SOPA was different from the DMCA and some of the ways in which it overlapped?
So some of the ways in which it was different. The idea, the supporters would say that SOPA applied to sites that were outside of U.S. jurisdiction. So where the DMCA provided a mechanism for content holders to give notice and get takedown for sites who had some operations in the U.S., there was a whole class of rogue foreign sites that that were outside of that system. And so SOPA was designed to address those. And the way that it would do that is by making U.S. companies that sort of allow U.S. customers to access those sites to take action against them. And so in the first draft of the bills, it was things like asking U.S. ISPs and DNS providers to cut off the DNS access to the site so that the domain didn't, when you type the domain name into your browser, it didn't resolve to the site. And also going to, for example, the payment processors or the ad networks for these sites, if they were American, and compelling them to stop doing business with the sites. And then also going to search engines and telling the search engines to dump these sites from their results. And so in that sense, it was those sorts of remedies are much broader than the kind of thing that's allowed under the DMCA. And then the other component that's different is that it expanded on the anti-circumvention clauses in the DMCA. So the DMCA says that if there's technology in place to prevent you from copying something, you can't go around that technology. And going around it, even to do something legal, is itself illegal. And that's called anti-circumvention. And SOPA, in order to prop up these remedies, like the blocking and the search engine blocking, included anti-circumvention clauses that said if you link to or discuss any techniques that would help you go around the SOPA censorship, then that itself is a crime. And so it added another level of liability for these circumvention rules. And in that way, this is sort of the big takeaway for a lot of user-generated content sites. It really diminished the safe harbor that is afforded to these sites under the Communications Decency Act, Section 230, and under the DMCA, that says that as long as you comply with the laws, the notice and takedown laws, you have a safe harbor and you're free of liability.
And we're not going to go into any of the DMCA exceptions or anything like that, but I do want to mention real quick for anybody who's, you know, any of that sounded like, well, that's not, you know, 100% accurate. There's going to be a link to some DMCA stuff in here. And I know, Parker, we've spoken briefly about, you know, some of the stuff that EFF is doing with exceptions to the circumvention stuff with the DMCA. But we don't really have time now to talk about that. I'm sure the DMCA will rear its ugly head in the future, and we can maybe discuss that at some later juncture, but not today.
Right. The DMCA is a really big law, and so there are parts of it that are good, and the notice and takedown is, you know, it's not perfect, but it is a good system for allowing innovation online, and then parts of it that are bad, and anti-circumvention is one of those. But yeah, that could be another hour.
Yeah, yeah.
The show could be 2 hours at this point. So I was going to actually ask Barker, kind of going along, since SOPA takes a more of an international approach, or at least that was the intent of what they were trying to pass here, there are already treaties and conventions, specifically the Berne Convention, that protects copyright in the international perspective from artists' work. So how does SOPA either differ, or what's it in relation to the Berne Convention?
Well, so SOPA is designed, it's really... I mean, it's aimed at these foreign sites, but it really is a domestic bill, and it's about addressing these or enforcement of these laws that otherwise you couldn't take in an international way, and so these conventions like Berne or other copyright and IP conventions and treaties
in Uruguay when. Came up in Gold right. recently.
Exactly. So a lot of that defines the way that the laws ought to be shaped, but it ends up not meaning that much if a site is based in a country that A, is not a signatory to these, or that B, just doesn't have the enforcement in place. And this has been the case for a long time with especially with countries in the BRIC zone, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. Some of these have agreed to copyright treaties and laws, but in practice, getting them enforced internationally wasn't really a possibility.
So this is another one of those tangents that we could spend an hour easily right. on. But while we're talking about international law, one of the things that has, you know, since the 18th come up is Mega Upload being shut down. And, you know, when Kim.com, which is, he should be arrested for naming himself that, but when Kim.com was arrested, he wasn't arrested in the U.S., he was arrested in New Zealand. So obviously they have, I mean, SOPA purported to do things that we didn't have jurisdiction or capabilities of doing, but clearly we're able to get, you know, the German government and the New Zealand government involved, and you know, get people from Mega Upload.
Right, and I think that's actually a really important point. Is that as it stands, these rogue sites that I mentioned that the supporters talk about, they haven't really been defined, and there isn't, no one in Hollywood has sort of put their foot down and says, well, what about this site? That there's no way to get it. As it stands, they haven't really gone after a site that has no connection to the U.S. and is therefore totally outside of the U.S. jurisdiction. In December, the U.S. Trade Representative put together an out-of-cycle special report to document these rogue sites. And the report included 19 examples of rogue sites, which was really at that point, the SOPA battle had already started heating up, and people were saying, okay, so this is actually about 19 sites. That's a problem. And Mega Upload was one of the sites on that list. So it kind of calls the whole list into question as to whether there are a class of these sites that really are causing a problem and that really are have no connection to the U.S. and can't be addressed under existing laws.
And again, I don't want this to turn into Mega Upload, but have you read the indictment of the Mega Upload? It's like 72 pages long or something. I mean, it's just
right.
a lot of things going on there. And I think people that have followed the MegaUpload.com situation probably know this, but that is sort of, there's more than meets the eye. I mean, Kim.com has a criminal history, and that's just sort of a messy situation. I sort of feel that, you know, the comparisons between like Dropbox and MegaUpload.com are maybe not as warranted as people might think. I don't know what your feelings on that are, but while we've got you here, I know there's probably going to be a lot of people listening to this that haven't done a whole lot of reading on MegaUpload, and so maybe you could just give a couple thoughts real quick on that.
I think you sort of hit the nail on the head when you called it messy. There are a lot of facts here, and some of them are very peculiar to MegaUpload, and Kim.com is certainly a character that will influence some people's opinion on this for sure. But it looks like one of the core facts has to do with the process. This is a technical thing, the process of what's called deduplication, where MegaUpload did this. It's really a standard procedure. If someone uploads a file and then another person uploads exactly the same file, and they can tell by you know, checking to make sure these files are exactly the same, then they only store one copy of the file. They take out the duplicates, and then the way MegaUpload was behaving was that if they were getting a takedown notice for a link on the site, they would take down the link, but they wouldn't take down the underlying file. And that is actually pretty standard practice among these file lockers. So obviously the situation and the facts around Dropbox look a little different from the facts around MegaUpload, but to the extent that this hinges on sort of a technical decision that a file locker site might make, that's a little bit of a scary precedent. But of course, this is it's a messy and long indictment, and so I personally, some of the lawyers here have read at the EFF have read all the way through it multiple times. I personally haven't read the entire thing, so I can't speak too much on the specifics.
As funny as people being arrested can be, I'm humored by the fact that this indictment goes into the quadruples of, I think, Z's, but, you know, it goes through like A and then, you know, all A through Z, AA through ZZ, AAA through ZZZ, and then starts with the quadruples. And I don't know, just that in and of itself, aside from any of the other situation, I find somewhat humorous.
I think the message here is be wary of anyone who talks about this like it's a simple case,
So anyway, like I said, I didn't want to go too far into that realm, but I don't know that all of the situations are completely, at least in the response, they've been sort of meshed together. Whether or not there is any real meshing at any sort of level, who knows? But I mean, there's certainly this common perception that, you know, there was some retaliation against MegaUpload for some of the things that had happened in December. And, you know, this whole SOPA thing, you know, came to a head on the 18th, January 18th to an extent. But, you know, we had American Censorship Day in November, I think it was. It's definitely been, I mean, and the legislation is, you know, a year old easily. I don't have the dates in front of me for Protect IP and for SOPA, both of them. You might have those. But, I mean, these didn't all of a sudden, you know, happen in October and November when people started paying attention to them. They've been around for a while. So
And they're both to some extent rewrites of legislation that was introduced in 2010 called COICA. And this is something that we've been following for a long time.
What are the letters on that?
The letters on COICA? Yes. That's COICA.
Right.
And that was introduced in 2010 and then put on hold indefinitely by Senator Wyden, which effectively killed the bill until it came back as Protect IP. And then that was modified a bit to become SOPA.
So, Parker, I mean, what was the biggest differences between PIPA and SOPA and as legislation, I guess, and also, well, yeah, yeah. And what would you qualify as the differences between?
So, both of these bills went through a number of pretty big changes, especially as opposition started to heat up. At first, they both had DNS provisions, the ones that I talked about at the beginning of the show, to cut off the domain from the server kind of thing, and there was a lot of technical opposition, and a lot of security guys said that would break a very important cybersecurity initiatives, and so in the last couple of days that these bills were around, both and actually this was before the 18th, the authors of both Protect IP and SOPA offered to take those sections out, and so that there's these sorts of like pretty big fundamental changes. By the end, on the 18th, the bills were fairly similar. Actually, some of the differences went down into sort of the legal minutiae. One difference that could end up being important, or could have ended up being important, was that Protect IP used a term to mean search engine that was actually much more broad. And so I believe the term was information access tool, which could have...
Sorry.
These bills were 80 pages long, and you have to look at every word and look at how they're defined in the context of that bill. And that actually could have had a lot broader implications. So in that sense, PIPA was a little bit worse there. But by the end, they ended up looking pretty similar.
So, and I guess for maybe some of the listeners out there that aren't as familiar with SOPA and PIPA and the whole blackout, I'm sure they've seen it and seen it in the news and everything. There's a lot of discussion about that if these things had passed, they'd be infringing on a lot of our constitutional rights and also on due process. How would that happen if these things had passed?
So the constitutional rights sort of the major component there is that these bills would have the effect of silencing non-infringing speech, and that actually even defenders of the bill, a lawyer for the MPAA, Floyd Abrams, who in a past life was a very outspoken First Amendment lawyer, he admitted that these bills would silence some non-infringing speech, but at a level that he deemed to be acceptable. But then you've got you've got other prominent First Amendment scholars like Marvin Amory, who came out and said that the way that these would take down sites that had some non-infringing content, but also some infringing content, perhaps, constitutes censorship in a way that conflicts with the First Amendment. The other aspect, I'm sorry, what was the other part of the question?
Well, I guess the other thing does SOPA require a court order? Due process.
Yeah,
I guess
due process. And so in the first draft of SOPA, you could go as a rights holder, you could go directly to the payment processors and ad networks and get the site cut off that way. And that was without a court order. By the time the first manager's amendment rolled around, that had been softened. So you did need a court order, but those court orders could be issued without hearing from the other side. So you could have a one-sided hearing, and then where only the rights holders got to present their evidence, and that could result in the sites being cut off at the DNS level and cut off from their payment processors and ad networks and dumped from search engines. And you can imagine that there would be, especially if these sites are international and don't have a big legal team and can't get to a U.S. courtroom to represent themselves, that could have the effect of silencing them and really declaring them guilty and cutting them off before they had anything like real due process. And then, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, it just sounds like the tactics of the Patriot Act.
Yeah, and we actually have seen, this is not a Patriot Act, but there is a law in the books that allows the ICE to seize domains already. And we've seen, especially with sites based overseas, but even with there was a domestic hip-hop blog called DaJazz One, which was seized by the ICE, even though it contained no infringing content.
This is a really incredible story.
Yeah, I'll try to compress it because, again, this could be an hour. But seized, and immediately they responded and said, "What's going on? Why is our site gone?" And it contained no infringing content. This was a hip hop blog that had received submissions from hip hop artists and record labels who liked the promotion. Uh-huh. And over the course of a year, they issued, they tried to go to the court over and over, and they had a prominent lawyer in this field representing them, and just going to the government and saying, "Tell us something, you know, tell us what the charges are, because we don't think that there's any merit here." And after a full year of the site being completely inaccessible, the government just dropped the charges and gave the site back. And so there was no case and no due process. And so this was completely non-infringing, completely valid speech being silenced without due process for a year by the government, and then there's no accountability. And so expanding that sort of program for people who are familiar with how it works seems like a bad idea, even if you've got government involvement. Mm-hmm. That's no guarantee of due process.
Yeah, so it's a little bit different, but I wouldn't say that it's a problem probably constitutionally with due process. But Open, or at least the last versions that I've heard of the Open Act, actually have all of the litigation taking place at the ITC in DC, and some commenters have said that presents problems. You know, rather than me being able to go down the street to the District Court of New Hampshire and filing, I would have to file in DC. So I guess first, just to kind of talk about, you know, specifically any due process stuff in Open, and then more generally, if you think Open is sort of the savior that some are making it out to be.
Yeah, so we have been, you know, we read the first draft of Open when it was released, and the ITC seems like it might be a more suitable place for this sort of discussion, you know, to the extent that this is a trade issue. If you're only talking about foreign sites, and especially if you're talking about counterfeit goods and such, the truth is, it was introduced by Representative Daryl Issa and Senator Ron Wyden, who both of whom have been really important voices in the fight against SOPA and PIPA, and really have brought a lot of reason to an otherwise heated debate. But we at EFF think that probably the answer to the problem that the content lobby have identified as piracy doesn't lie in more legislation. That we've already started to see market solutions emerge that will be much more effective. And so as it stands, the problem isn't really well defined, and the solution probably doesn't lie in legislation. So there will be issues with anything that's introduced. And I think Open is a much more narrowly targeted, and in that sense, better proposal than SOPA and PIPA were. But legislation is probably not the answer here.
So on that note, you know, legislation not being the answer, but if you had to, you know, say that legislation was going to happen, You know, was there anything good about SOPA? I mean, a lot of the issues with those two, with PIMA and SOPA, had to do with infringing copyright, but there were a lot of trademark provisions in there as well. And there were some people that weren't really, you know, the copyright industry that were really on board with SOPA and PIPA. And so do those people, the manufacturing industry, the people that are concerned about, you know, their basically the consumer protection aspects of SOPA, was there anything salvageable in that? Is that any of that retained in open, or has it all sort of been lost into the behemoth that is the MPAA?
I think that you're correct that some of the supporters of this bill tried to position it as being about all sorts of issues and not just copyright. But it ended up being very largely about the MPAA and about their position. There are already laws on the books, and I'm not a legal expert on trade law or anything, but there are laws on the books about counterfeit goods and entering the U.S. And in fact, during the only hearing that was held about SOPA in the House, in the Judiciary Committee in particular, they had representatives from you know, the pharmaceutical industry, for example, and these representatives were talking about the importance of a bill like SOPA, why they needed something like SOPA, but their presentation was using examples of groups that had been successfully taken down by existing law, and so.
They didn't do themselves
yeah.
favors.
Yeah, no, not great presentations.
Right, and that's, I mean, it, you know, there were some impressive images, and when you see, you know, these sort of third world structures that are filled with counterfeit pharmaceuticals, you understand that that's dangerous. But the reason these pictures exist is because there's already a process in place for dealing with this, and also just as a separate notion. The issue of, say, counterfeit pharmaceuticals or trademark violations seems to be different enough from you know, downloading movies online that it probably makes sense to address these with different laws. And so there might have been some stuff that overlapped, and there may have even been some stuff that would have been helpful to the pharmaceutical industry or to trademark holders. And if they want to pursue a law there that seems necessary, and if they've got the evidence to back up why they need such a law, then that should probably happen in a place that in a forum that isn't dominated by the MPAA and by discussions about how to prevent you know, American teenagers from downloading the latest Hollywood blockbusters. Those are substantially different issues.
Just for your own, mostly for your own personal knowledge on this, one of the reasons that I guess that piece of the legislation interests me is because my roommate last semester is a lawyer in Argentina, and so they have, you know, basically fairs where these sorts of things happen, where people will bring the, you know, I don't know what all sorts of goods end up getting, you know, mislabeled, but the fake Louis Vuittons and whatnot. And so there's you know, basically it's legalized in the sense that it's not cracked down on, you know, the, you know, acres and acres of fairs of people just distributing all these goods. And so that's the image that I have when I'm thinking about that. And I wonder too, you know, they have these laws on the books, but I don't know. Do any of those speak specifically to websites that are doing this? I mean, I know that there are, you know, the goods that are coming into the country, you know, that they can deal with it at that level. But, you know, this was actually going at the internet level. So it seems like it's a little different target. Maybe it's not a target that they need to take, but I just, I know you said you weren't an expert in those laws, but I just wondered if you knew anything about the capabilities that they had actually going after the websites that are doing infringing, rather than waiting until money had already exchanged hands and the goods were coming to the border.
Yeah, well, I think that gets back to sort of one of the root problems with SOPA and PIPA, which is that until that is documented, until the problem is clearly defined, it's hard to have a real solution. So it's worth noting that SOPA and PIPA were only aimed at these U.S. directed goods and websites. So it wasn't so these trade fairs in Argentina, all of that that is domestic or that's between countries wouldn't even be touched by this. You know, this is just for things entering the United States. So it makes sense to regulate that at the level of things actually entering the United States. That said, until the problem is clearly documented and defined, and until there's some evidence on which to base the policy, there are problems with going after it with a solution that is known to have a lot of side effects.
Well, Parker, I was going to actually say, the other thing is, it seems like SOPA and PIPA are they're not necessarily dead, but they're definitely down and not seeming like they're going to be coming back up in the immediate future. But it's likely that it will come back, especially since the U.S. State Department is still promoting things that are along the SOPA policies through the State Departments and pressuring other countries. But I guess the question is really, what do we do to prepare ourselves, and how do we, as activists ourselves, try to prevent this from coming back up again?
Well, some of that is vigilance, and I think keeping an eye on these laws that the U.S. State Department is advancing. You've got one in Spain, and Ireland has some dangerous policies on the horizon. Canada also has laws that are a little more complex, but certainly threatening. So some of that is vigilance. Of course, there's ACTA, the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, which again, that could be another hour. But and I think some of this is a little bit of proactive and positive agenda making. I think we've reached a moment in the U.S. where these issues, which at one point were really reserved for the nerds, copyright and internet policy. It's something that, you know, I'd bring up at a party and get a lot of blank stares. They've hit the mainstream, and now might be the time to pursue an agenda that either rolls back some of the bad laws that have been passed in the last few years, or that really establishes limits proactively. And we're working on how that might take shape here, but I think that it's something that all activists who are thinking about copyright issues, especially copyright and free speech issues, should be thinking about how to shape. I know that one thing that's been really encouraging is that the huge backlash to SOPA has been co-opted in a way that's refreshing by activists in other countries. And so Ley Cinde is a Spanish law that resembles SOPA and that was pushed by the U.S. trade representative. And seeing activists in Spain call this Spanish SOPA, mm-hmm. and putting together activism around that message is really great. And I hope that continues to work. I hope that this moment gets extended as long as it can, and the enthusiasm here continues to fight back against these bad laws.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it seems like there's an opportunity, especially with a lot of the occupies going on, that there's a space to have the discussion and educate people on what it means and why it's what the bad things are about it. It's inspiring to me because, unfortunately, there were a good amount of labor unions that were actually in support of it, and that really bothered me as a labor activist myself. But seeing that even a local Occupy in like Occupy Boston, where I used to be active before moving where I am now in Mexico, I actually put a proposal together that was passed by the GA in opposition to SOPA, and others had done the same, which is good, I think, at least. But
yeah, inspiring. That's great. These issues are really important, and the fewer glazed over looks you can get, the better, because increasingly every day, copyright laws really affect each of us and affect our abilities to speak. And that's a new thing. You know, it wasn't like that before the internet, and it wasn't like that, you know, in the 50s and 60s. But now this is something that we have to monitor and to make sure that it's not used as a mechanism for censorship.
Well, Parker, thanks so much for coming on. I certainly learned a lot, even though, you know, I've been following these issues. It's just there's so much going on, and we're really lucky to have an organization like EFF helping to keep everybody informed on what's going on, and not only keeping people informed, but you know, doing some of the groundwork and fighting to keep these things from going through.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure discussing this with you guys.
Thank you very much, Parker, as well. It's really informative for me, and not being as much of the legal mind as the two of you are. It's very informative, and it makes sense to me much more than it did before. Thank you.
Great.